Reverend Dr. Andrew Davison, thank you very much for joining me today in this podcast. And yeah, I would like to start with the recent news that spoke about your work. And I think 2 months ago, there were a series of articles. There was one published on the Times, and then there was another one published on New York Post that was titled NASA Hired 24 Theologians to Study Human Reaction to Aliens. What was that about?
That was about a research project which was undertaken in Princeton about 4 or 5 years ago now. It was based at the Center of Theological Inquiry in the middle of Princeton, which is a research institution, a think tank, I suppose. It convenes research programs. And NASA had sponsored them to do some work over 3 years on what they called the societal implications of astrobiology. So astrobiology is about thinking about the place of life in the universe. And societal implications are, what will everyone think if we have evidence of life elsewhere in the universe? And NASA fund all sorts of wonderful research, including work in the arts and humanities, to help disseminate their ideas and help them be taken up by people who work in philosophy and theology and literature and so on. And in this case, they were working with religious figures. And I think what's going on there is very sensible. The idea that if there's evidence for life elsewhere in the universe, a very large proportion of the world's population will turn to religious traditions to try and understand what's going on for an interpretation. So as I see it, they were saying it pays to have given people the resources to think about these things in advance. I think that's a great idea. If you're thinking on your feet when news comes out, it's going to be not very well resourced. It could be a bit panicked, you know, whereas if people have put the time in advance, it's going to be more measured and, you know, deeply resourced. So there were across these 3 years, there were 24 of us who all spent in 1 year or another 9 months in Princeton. And it was an amazingly wide range, you know, a range of religious traditions. Christianity was predominant because that's the tradition that the center's coming out of, but there were definitely other traditions as well. And some people were looking at it from more of an ethical, philosophical perspective. And we weren't supposed to do anything that kind of added up across the project. It was just go out there, do 24 different things and see what comes of it. And my work was to write a book, really, which is going to be out later this year, looking at the question, if you opened your newspaper tomorrow and there was evidence of life elsewhere in the universe, what difference would it make to Christian belief? And I particularly wanted to broaden out the range of topics that are looked at and to go beyond just repeating some of the things that have been said in the past, because that's a really interesting story you could talk about, the way in which there's this long history of writing about this topic within Christianity. But people have generally been so unworried about it that they've just written a sentence here or a paragraph there and moved on. And in a way, that's wonderful that they haven't been so concerned about it. But it means that there was, I think, quite a lot of work to be done digging a bit deeper. And that's okay. What I was trying to do. And it was fascinating the way in which it caught the public imagination. So there's that piece just before Christmas in the Times.
Yes.
And within a few weeks, I'd found about 140 different news outlets had covered it, not always entirely accurately. So some of them said that I'd been hired directly by NASA, which isn't the case. And some of them had got the chronology wrong. So it was about I was just about to start this. And of course, this does remain a really important part of my research. And so it's not like I've let it go, but it was as if I was about to join the NASA payroll.
Yeah, and also the title was a bit misleading because when they mention aliens, people immediately think about intelligent aliens.
That's right.
Coming to our planet and maybe invading our planet or
exactly.
Like
they
that,
like
right?
They like the dramatic stories, the science fiction stories. And one of the things that the scientists have been saying as long as I've been involved in this field is not all life will be intelligent. I mean, maybe the tiniest fraction, if there is any, will be intelligent. So there always was an encouragement for us to think about the equivalent of bacteria living in rock pools.
Microbial life.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, you know, I think people in theology, probably in philosophy too, literature, will tend to gravitate towards things that are a bit considered to be a bit more like ourselves, because then you can ask additional questions
yes.
about good and evil and so on. And I'm also not thinking particularly about life that's visiting us. So I think that's one of the things that's changed in the science. Until recently, our best bet for detecting life elsewhere in the universe was going to be to detect the signals of advanced life. So that could be radio broadcasts.
With a SETI program.
With a SETI program, or, you know, potentially, I suppose, a visit. Although I think interstellar travel could be extraordinarily difficult. But with the Hubble Space Telescope, other telescopes, and especially now with the James Webb Space Telescope, we're going to be really well placed to detect the signs of any life, especially in the traces it leaves in the atmosphere of a planet. And so that
within the resolution limits of the James Webb Telescope, because they cannot go to very thin atmospheres, I think there is a limit in the thickness they can detect, right?
Absolutely. There's lots of work to be done, but it's still a bit of a step change in terms of what we're going to be able to do. And that opens up the possibility of being able to detect just life as such, you know, bacterial life or whatever, rather than having to wait for it to get to the, you know, like a human being in the late 19th century first doing radio broadcasts or something like that.
Do you think NASA was worried about something specific when they launched this investigation, when they contacted the Center for Theological Inquiry? Were they worried about something, societal implications like unrest or riots, things like that? Or maybe just the church losing followers?
Well, I think I didn't pick up any sign of a particular agenda. I think that they support so much work, you know, probably unsung, unknown work in arts and humanities and general public understanding, that I think one needs to assume that there's some news around the corner and they're preparing the world for it. I think it makes sense that that's just one of the things that they did. Yeah, I'm afraid that doesn't make necessarily for very good headlines, but yeah. I didn't pick up any particular hidden story.
Yeah.
It was fascinating the way in which it was covered. So this news, they always picked up on the fact that I'm a clergyman, a priest, for instance. So all the pictures they found on the internet were with either me in a dog collar or, you know, at the altar saying mass or something like that. So I think it really captured the imagination, the idea of someone who is a theologian but also a priest working on these scientific topics.
So you got a PhD in biochemistry, and then after that you moved to theology.
That's right.
It's a bit weird as a transition. What motivated your choice of undertaking a career in theology after your studies in biology? Was it like something you observed in biology, in the biochemistry?
Well, I had started off, with a chemistry degree first and then a DPhil in biochemistry. And really, it comes down to two things. I mean, our stories are difficult, and you know, to analyze, and who knows. But I think I can put it down to two factors. One was that I'd started to work in the hospice in Oxford as a volunteer in the evenings, sometimes in the weekends, and it was so much the most rewarding thing that I did. I mean, obviously, often quite traumatic, but it really felt like it touched a vocation in me. So I thought then that pushed me towards a more pastoral career, you know, trajectory. Mm. And I also recognised that I was lying awake thinking about theology, philosophy, these sorts of things. I wasn't, to be honest, lying awake thinking about biochemistry. And that seemed to me quite a good indication. Maybe that's a good principle I should talk to students about if they're trying to discern their way through life. Ask what it is that you lie awake thinking about. So the second of those, I suppose, led me towards a theology degree, and the first one framed the context in which that happened, which was coming to Cambridge to train for ordination in the Church of England. So they paid for my theology degree, and I left and worked in a parish in an estate in the southeast of London, Bellingham, where I had a terrific time. And I guess in the end, I didn't quite make escape velocity from the university, although I imagined I would be working the parishes. And a job came up in Oxford to teach theology, and I threw my hat into the ring, and I got it. And so I've been teaching in the university since then. I taught theology in Oxford and then back here in Cambridge. But that was really core Christian theology, God, creation, evil, redemption, Jesus, all these sorts of things. And my scientific interests have become, you know, private ones. I certainly read science still, but it wasn't particularly part of my work. And then 8 years ago, a position at the University of Cambridge came up in theology and natural sciences in the Divinity Faculty. There aren't that many permanent endowed positions. There are some, and there's one in Cambridge. And you know, I again threw my hat into the ring and got that job. So rather wonderfully, these two parts of my story, my life, came back together in one job. And I can't tell you how much I love doing it.
Okay. And now you are involved in this initiative, this new initiative for understanding the life in the universe with the Luverum grant.
That's right.
Grant. What's that about?
Well, a few years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, before Didier Queloz had been rewarded the Nobel Prize, I think, we'd started to get to know one another. I mean, obviously the scientists, many of them knew one another, but there was a new impetus in the university to think how widely we could throw the net to people who were thinking about life elsewhere in the universe. I think within the arts and humanities school, the faculties in that school, I was the only one. So I got involved with them. And that meant that when the Leverhulme bid, offer came out for bids for a centre, funding for a centre, we were kind of primed to go. I think so much that happens in the world, I was going to say in academia, but frankly in everything, rests on friendships. And I think the fact that there were some pre-existing friendships really helped there. So we were ready to go. And as you do, we spent about a year, I think, putting this bid together.
Okay.
First of all, it had to be sponsored by the university. Then it had to go to the national competition. And yeah, we were one of the three centres, I think, that won funding this year. Which is, you know, I still can't quite believe it, really, because it's tremendously generous, £1 million a year for 10 years. And whereas government funding tends to be quite a lot of paperwork, and, you know, you're hardly starting on one piece of work before you're having to put the proposal in for the next, and you spend a really large part of your time writing applications. The Leverhulme Trust, there's a bit of monitoring, and as there should be, diligence and so on. But if they like what you're proposing and they're going to support it, they really just, I think, let you go on with it. And they also tend to sponsor sort of high-risk, high-outcome work,
yeah,
which government bodies tend not to do. So I hope that after 10 years, we'll have really transformed the international conversation about the origins of life. I hope we have very high aspirations anyway. And you know, who knows whether we'll have any data to work on.
Yeah.
But so it's high risk, high outcome, I think. And I'm really grateful for that. And I suppose the other thing to mention is that we can't take it for granted that arts and humanities perspectives would be included in a bid like this. I think it's one of the things that set us apart, really. And I was delighted.
It's unusual.
But unusual, yeah. I mean, it's wonderfully interdisciplinary, but we might expect that would be between earth sciences and chemistry, or between astrophysics and zoology. But for there to be Faculty of Divinity involved, I brought the mathematicians in, and I think there's some really interesting work to be done there, which we could talk about. History and philosophy of science is involved, but the lead faculty, because I was the person on that, was Divinity. And of course we also represent philosophical traditions in the Divinity faculty.
Yeah.
And I really have found the scientists to be interested in philosophical questions, thinking about what literature, history, so on brings to the table. And that's one of the things about Cambridge, I suppose, that I love. I don't want to contrast it with other places, but certainly it's true of Cambridge, whatever else you would say of anywhere else, that especially the college system means that people from all these different subjects are together, eating together, running a college together, on the gardens committee together, and this sort of thing. And so you do have conversations sparked across disciplines, and I think Cambridge is a great place to be doing that.
Yeah, so one of the biggest questions is how did life begin? And but some people might say, well, we don't have time machines, we cannot go back in time, and even if we could go back in time, it would be very hard to find where life emerged from prebiotic chemistry. Then other people might even say, well, there are so many pathways that might lead from basic ingredients to more complex molecules until the sort of abiogenesis. So maybe some people say a better question is, how can we synthesize life in a lab? So how can theology help shaping these sort of questions, and how does the church sees this sort of attempt by scientists, as someone says, to play God? Because they say, oh, they're trying to play God in the lab.
Well, one thing I'd say is that there's a strong tradition for the theologian, for the religious voice, not wanting to displace the scientist. So I think, certainly my own perspective, I'd want to say that part of what it means to be a human being is to investigate the world, and that's a good thing. I'd see it as a part of the human vocation. I think it's easily rolled up within the religious vision. And so I wouldn't particularly want to see the theological perspective wanting to trump the theologian or say, well, what do you know about science? We know about science. That's not the way I'd look at it. So I think there's going to be a lot of receptivity, really. The theology is an amazingly omnivorous discipline. It's kind of interested in everything, and it wants to know about the world that it studies. And I'm not going to try and teach the scientists their job.
You don't think there is any moral issue in trying to synthesize life from scratch? Because someone might say, well, on another level, maybe the church might be against cloning humans. Almost everybody is against cloning humans. Or maybe someone might say we're against cloning animals. But if you go up to the basics, you might say, well, maybe we're against creating life from scratch, because that's not something that belongs to the scientists, it's something that God did.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe there is no issue there.
Well, I think we are a long way off from creating
life.
What we are doing is finding ways in which building blocks can be created, and maybe some of the beginnings of certain metabolic pathways and self-sustaining reactions and that sort of thing. I think that's so far away from the life that we're familiar with that I don't see that as a legitimate task. I think the theologian, but everybody else really, is always going to be having an eye on ethics in terms of dangers. So we certainly should be very careful not to do anything that's going to, you know, turn and consume ourselves or anything like that. You know, so there are all sorts of questions
sort
about due diligence
goo
and
nanobots
safety.
And things spreading everywhere and
yeah,
eating
exactly.
The entire world.
But I see it really the work that the scientists are doing as about exploring possibilities. And of course, we don't really know exactly what the conditions were like on Earth where life evolved. Of course, there'd be millions, billions of different conditions out there. So it's about exploring under these sorts of conditions what sorts of reactions take place that might lead to the sorts of building blocks that we need. It's also about thinking about different ways of conceiving of life. So there's people might put the emphasis on metabolism and on self-sustaining chemical reactions. Other people might put the emphasis on information, in which case you probably think that something a bit more like DNA or RNA came first and the rest gets assembled around that. So I think exploring lots of different options is going to be very sensible, because we have every reason to suppose that there are lots of different conditions out there. You've touched on the question about whether we need to think about the origin of life as being something outside of a natural process. And I, as a theologian, and for that matter, as a religious believer, wouldn't want to say that.
Okay.
I'm perfectly happy to think that life can emerge by natural processes. And I don't think that that makes it any less wonderful. In a sense, what you're doing is you're transferring the wonder to say, rather than this having to be some kind of thing that's not what the universe is like, so the universe couldn't do this naturally, so God has to sort of go beyond it.
The intelligent design argument.
That sort of thing. We're saying, actually, the wonderful thing is that the very nature of reality itself is that it has this capacity to bring forth life. I don't think that's any less wonderful. In fact, in some ways, it's even more remarkable than saying that the natural processes have to be suspended for this to happen.
So religious people believe that humans have souls. I'm not the expert, but if I have a dog and I love this dog, maybe I would think that dog has a soul as well. I don't know if what's the perspective there.
Well, you know what I'm going to say to you here is, of course, it depends what you mean by soul. So if you take Aristotle's perspective, which has been very influential, particularly influential in the Roman Catholic Church, but I'm an Anglican. I think Aristotle's got a lot going for him. Then soul names what's different between a living thing and a non-living thing, which is that it has its own principle of movement within it. Mm. So we have this idea of animation. It's the same word anima for we get is a soul. So he thinks that every material thing can be analysed in terms of what it's made out of and what it adds up to. That's the matter and the form. And the form is what distinguishes one material thing from another. And perhaps the biggest distinction in nature for Aristotle is between just art objects, inanimate things, which have a form. I mean, they add up to something. They're a coordinated whole. And those material things which have life, which have a principle of movement within them. So a ball will roll down a hill, but it, not of itself. It's drawn down by gravity. Whereas even the simplest living thing has some animation, some principle of movement within it. So on that basis, if you defined soul that way, every living creature would be having a soul.
Well, if we talk about soul in spiritual terms, I think some sort of something that is beyond this world, beyond the natural world. Do you think animals have souls? What's the perspective?
So I suppose the question here is about whether this principle of what they are has a life beyond death, I suppose. That's a good dividing line. Yeah, there's a lot of work on animals within theology at the moment, and there would certainly be more people than before who would want to posit some...
dogs or cats.
Some existence, you know, or participation in the resurrection or whatever. So the great big transitions, it seems to me, are between nothing and something.
Okay.
Between non-living and living, and... within theology, a particular attention also to the distinction between the intelligent and the non-intelligent, or the conscious. And I think science would still point to these as being particularly significant distinctions. And I think religious traditions, well, let me speak for Christianity, have tended to think about that transition from the difference between the non-conscious and the conscious as being some direct act of God. But like I've said with life, I'd kind of rather give science a run for its money, if possible. I know there are actually plenty of scientists and philosophers today who are saying we're no closer to solving the problem of consciousness than we were, you know, it's that so-called hard problem. But I, you know, perhaps unusually, given that I'm coming at this then as a theologian, would say I kind of don't like God of the gaps arguments. I don't like saying, oh, well, the reason you'd believe in God is because somehow this natural process doesn't work.
You cannot explain that thing, so you put God in
exactly.
The thing.
Exactly. Well, I'd rather see God in the whole. And I think on consciousness, on what's so special about humanity, I'm an emergentist. So I would at least want to explore the idea that once you get a sufficiently complicated system, new properties emerge.
Yeah.
In fact, even you only need three objects and you already have properties and behavior that you don't have with two. There are only three things in the world that would be moving with gravity that would already add a complexity that wouldn't be present with two. The three-body problem. We see this all around. And the human brain is the most complex thing in the universe that we know of. Maybe there are other things with equally complex equivalents, but... I would at least want to explore the idea or give some credence to the idea that just the human brain is sufficiently complicated that whole new forms of behavior and properties emerge, which include consciousness, and not have to see that as some kind of tinkering, you know. But official Roman Catholic teaching would be that there is an evolutionary story all the way up to the human being in terms of our bodies, but the distinction between every other creature and the human being is something that's directly created by God. I just kind of like that. I'd like to give the scientists a bit more time to come up with an account of where consciousness comes from, because I don't feel theologically threatened by the idea that there could be a natural origin for it.
Yeah, so the reason why I was asking you whether animals have souls or not is because if you go back to simpler and simpler organisms, you might say, well, we create life from scratch. Would that life have a soul?
There is a kind of reductio ad absurdum, isn't there? That you end up with every amoeba that's ever existed, you know, has a a place in the life of the world to come. And I think that is actually ends up being a pretty good argument about having to say you have to draw a line somewhere. But as I say, there's a lot of work on this. C.S. Lewis, well-loved English writer, he generally didn't think that there was that kind of continued existence for non-humans, except for he was quite soft towards animals. You know, he was a great animal lover. And he wondered whether animals that had been domesticated and taken into a family could become kind of part of the family. It's all very speculative. And there's a lovely poem by Dorothy L. Sayers, another English writer about the same time as Lewis, where she asks God to give a life, you know, continued life to her cat.
Okay.
Because it has been an opportunity for her to show goodness and kindness. So it's not because the cat's been kind to her, but she's so grateful to the cat because it's been an opportunity for her to grow in love and kindness and so on, that she thinks it's become part of her story and she wants it gathered up. Anyway, this is all very speculative stuff, but I could point to any number of people who are writing on this sort of topic at the moment.
Okay. So philosophers and theologians can certainly help with the definition of life.
Let me say on that I'm going to leave the scientists to get on with their work, but I do think there are a couple of places where the theologian may well be a custodian of a wise philosophical tradition. So I've already talked about Aristotle and that idea of life being characterized by movement.
Okay.
I think he was really onto something, and we know even more than he did that life is characterized by movement of ions through channels in membranes and things. So really, movement's very important. And there's another thing that I've noticed in reading quite ancient texts, sometimes theological texts about life, which is this idea of life being characterized by a kind of will to preservation. There's a kind of will towards life. Life is self-repairing, it defends itself, pushes back against onslaughts. And again, I think that tradition kind of knew more than it recognized, because we see with the immune system and living things being self-repairing that there's something there. So I don't, again, think that the theologians, the philosophers are going to be teaching the scientists their job, but they might say, do you know, there's actually quite a rich seam, a rich vein of writing on life. And these people weren't, just because they lived a long time ago, they weren't stupid.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I want to help broker in this new centre, and hope we'll see a lot of, is just opening the treasure troves and seeing what people have written about life and seeing whether it provokes the scientists to useful thought.
So there might be good suggestions from previous thinkers.
I hope so. Yeah. Is it Lewis again who said, you know, we need to be careful of chronological snobbery, that somehow we think that we are uniquely...
Because we tend to dismiss what was done in the past because maybe they didn't have our knowledge and, of course, our technology and so on. In your book, you mention NASA's definition of life as a... Well, if you go and check, it says it's a self-sustaining chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution. But then, I mean, this kind of definition seems to exclude supernatural entities like God, the angels, and so on, but also super AI and conscious AI. So,
And sterile hybrids like mules, for instance.
Yes, and the issue is that if you remove the term chemical from the definition, then you could say that the computer virus could be alive, which is not the case. So are you happy with this definition? What do you think is wrong with this definition provided by NASA? Because that's something you discuss in your book.
Well, one of the things that's going on with the definition of life here is trying to know what to recognize if you saw it.
Yeah.
And that's tricky because we only got one example to go on, and we're trying to extrapolate from that to think, what are the qualities, how might it affect the world around it in such a way that we'd even recognize that it was there? And I mean, I think it's fine, but you've pointed to a couple of the problems with it. One is that it seems to me capable of Darwinian evolution. It's more important that it has an evolutionary past than it has an evolutionary future. So we might believe that every living thing has got to where it is by evolution. I don't think that then commits us to say that every living thing then has to be capable of evolution.
Because otherwise it wouldn't apply for mules, as you said.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, they might say that that's just being pedantic, but, mules are living things and they can't have offspring.
Yeah.
But also, if we imagine life that's either been created in silicon, you know, in a computer setting, if that's possible, or that's migrated there, I'm very, very sceptical about that, but people talk about it. then it wouldn't be necessary for that to have evolutionary capacities for it still to be living. And then the chemical thing, well, Aristotle makes this distinction between form and matter, the sort of substrate and then the way that the substrate is formed, what it amounts to. And it seems to me life is a formal concept, not a material one. It's kind of underdetermined as to what the matter it would be realized in, what that would be.
So it's an emerging property.
It's an emerging property. Yeah. Form is something that is associated with what emerges. And so, yeah, I think we need to be, it's the job of philosophers to be pedantic, I suppose, and maybe everything that we would ever find out there would be realized in chemistry, but it's no, well, this is a huge question, but we should at least entertain the idea that it could be realized in logic gates, for instance.
Yeah. And if you could go back in time and talk to San Tommaso d'Aquino and ask him what's life, what would he reply?
Oh, Thomas Aquinas is a good Aristotelian on this, so he would say it's those substances that are characterized by self-movement, I think.
Okay. So how would you approach the definition of life now? What would be the sort of roadmap to approach this concept right now?
Well, movement, both external and internal, self-repair and having an interest in continuing. There's some good work I've really enjoyed reading by Stuart Kaufman, who talks about how with the emergence of life, you have entities that have an interest in the world around them.
Okay.
And obviously you have some very simple life, but even the very simple life is in some way open to information about the world about beyond it, and in some way reacts to that in its own interest to modify it. I think it's what the phenomenologists might call it, the kind of philosopher would call intentionality, having a kind of directedness towards the world and a kind of receptivity. So I think that's quite an interesting angle on what life is. And then the theologian, the philosopher, might also want to say things that the scientist, just qua scientist, can't or isn't going to be saying, like that life's precious, for instance, or that it's worth protecting. Or
so qualities of life.
Yeah, which I don't think the scientist is going to want to often deny as a human being, but might say it just falls beyond the purview of my particular discipline to address. Of course, when you get the unfortunate situation of people thinking that their own discipline answers every possible question, then they might say, oh, well, it's not a scientific question, therefore it doesn't even have any kind of answer or doesn't make any kind of sense. That kind of position turns up from time to time, but I think it's more likely to be the intellectual pundit on social media saying that than necessarily the scientist.
Yeah, because otherwise you wouldn't have philosophy. Now, talking about domains, because that starts the conversation about domains, what are the domains of science and theology? How do you know things in science and how do you know things in theology? What's the sort of epistemology approach in the two cases?
Well, I think the main thing I want to say about these general questions of domains and intersections and so on is that it was really important in theology and science work in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of what was written was about possible modes of interaction and kind of taxonomies of modes of interaction. And I could talk a bit about that, but I think that actually what is almost most significant, most characteristic of work on theology and science in the last couple of decades, last decade maybe, has been to move away from that, to move away from generalized questions, as if there was science in general, there was religion in general, and they had these very second-order methodological questions about what even the possibility would be or the mode of a dialogue. One of the reasons that that has faded is because it was quite reactive. It was quite was seeking to even show that such a discipline or conversation was possible. And I think there's some terrific work by historians in the past couple of decades that have shown that the idea of an inevitable conflict between science and religion is a bit of a myth, really. It's a sort of construct of the late 19th century. And once they've shown that a long history of fruitful conversations, you don't need to be quite so bothered about trying to prove that even such a thing is possible. I think there's also a move in philosophy of science away from thinking about science as one big undifferentiated lump. So you'll find now people writing books on philosophy of physics, philosophy of biology, and not just treating it as if it was all one thing. So the idea that you could have these bird's eye views about science in general, theology in general, I think is just a little bit less of characteristic of the moment, even in philosophy of science. And I think theology is probably more in touch with its roots and its traditions than perhaps it was a few decades ago. So maybe it felt a little bit on the back foot. It was not so interested in its deep historical traditions, whereas nowadays theology is often characterized by sort of creative retrieval. So how can a dialogue with the great traditions and writer texts of the past be productive for thinking about questions today? So that tends to make the theology more specific, because once you're actually digging into the detail, you tend to be a Calvinist, an Augustinian, a Thomist, or whatever. You're looking at these historical figures. You're not particularly interested in theology in general. So, yeah, for all those reasons, I would say that big methodological questions about what could even the modes of interaction be have been rather eclipsed, and people just get on with the detail now. So there's something that started up in Scotland at St Andrews. John Perry up there came up with the idea of science engaged theology. You just wanted the theology to get engaged with the science and get on with it. And I think that probably characterizes my own work too. So I mean, every now and again when I'm asked to, I'll write questions about the very state or the very idea of a dialogue. But most of the time I just say, right, there's this development in evolutionary theory, there's this question in artificial intelligence, there's this thing in cosmology or life elsewhere in the universe, and try and dig into the detail and make it quite specific and bring it into conversation with some quite specific theology. So I think that, yeah, the general questions, they feel a little bit like of the last generation, really.
Okay. So there are certainly plenty of intersections between science and theology. You are interested in these kind of questions, but when I think about, I was thinking about potential intersections, like probably the most obvious. Are you aware of that feast of San Gennaro in Napoli?
Yeah, I've been to Naples just afterwards.
So basically,
actually,
they have this vial with the solid liquid. They say it's the blood from San Gennaro.
Mm-hmm.
And then the priest holds the vial and then says some prayer, and then the vial, upon shaking, becomes liquid again. And then you could have some scientist that goes there and inspects the vial and tries to figure out what's going on. That's an example of an intersection.
Mm-hmm.
Another example of intersection would be, okay, we look at the history of geology, what happened during the last ice age, and it seems that there is some evidence that there might have been floods 11,700 years ago. Now, that's written in the Genesis. So that might support what's written in the Genesis. Maybe that's because of oral tradition. Who knows? Mm-hmm. What are the most interesting intersections from your perspective? These are very simple ones, but what are the most interesting for you?
Well, on those questions about the Bible, I've again and again observed that it tends to be devout scientists who try to turn to the science to validate the story. Whereas the biblical scholars tend, even if they're quite devout themselves, to think that these are stories from a long time ago. Ideas of history were different then. Maybe we shouldn't read these texts in quite the same genre as if they were textbooks or, you know, something like that. So you get this interesting spectacle of the scientists quite often, even if for religious reasons, trying to come up with arguments from science about why these things are where they are. And the biblical scholars saying, of course, we don't think there was a flood that covered the whole earth. Or
not the whole earth, but maybe some regions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I again, I don't want to say that people a long time ago were stupid. They may have had historical traditions that they were dealing with, but I'm not really involved at all in the idea of scientific investigations of biblical texts. I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm a systematic theologian or a philosophical theologian, so I tend to work with quite the sort of big concepts that emerge from the study of the scriptures and the tradition all as a whole, rather than necessarily looking at details like that.
Okay, another intersection would be when God, for those who believe, intervenes or interacts with the natural world. So in your perspective, from your perspective, I mean, in the scriptures, there is probably the best example is Jesus that comes to our planet and incarnation and so on. So, but before the emergence of intelligent beings like us, well, there are mentions of God interacting with the world, but what's the current perspective? Does God kickstart the universe with the, let's say, Big Bang, or does it intervene with the evolution? You hinted before that that's not the case, but what's your perspective?
My worry about the language of interaction...
Intervention.
Yeah. ..is that it seems to put God and the and creatures too much on the same level. And one of the things that theologians are always interested in doing is trying to take divine transcendence seriously enough, that the creator of all things can't be just one more creature, thing like a creature. The cause of all things can't be just one more cause. And so I think there's almost a sort of domesticated view of God to think that God has to tinker or to draw near. I mean, there's a lot of, I think, very good work done in the last couple of decades about how it's the otherness of God from the world that is the reason that God can also be close to things. So people, Catherine Tanner talks about a non-competitive paradigm, that things that are similar to one another exclude one another or compete with one another, that it's actually the profound difference of how God is conceived from creatures that allows for there to be some, overlaps the wrong word, but interpenetration or something between God and creatures without it being
on another dimension, but
on
within...
another level. So one of the ways in which I like to discuss this in lectures is the idea that God isn't, so we think about creation, and I think it's, you know, Stephen Hawking, fantastic, obviously one of the great physicists, doesn't really get the theology quite right in some of his writings. He says, well, God is the one who knocks over the first domino, who lights the fuse. But so if you can imagine a kind of whole row of arrows that are like causes, this is the idea that God is just one big cause at the beginning. But the theological tradition is much more likely to say that God's like the cause underneath all causes holding them up, rather than just being one more in the sequence of causes. So one of the ways that this turns up is discussions in the High Middle Ages about whether the world could be eternal or not. And there's difference of opinion and lots of exchange and so on, but we've mentioned Thomas Aquinas already. He said it's not against the idea of creation for it always to have existed, because it's not about what God did at some putative initial point. It's about why there's anything rather than nothing. It's why, even at this very moment, being is sustained rather than falling away. And so he says creation is a relationship of dependence plus an inception. And then he backs off and he says, actually, the inception isn't necessary. What really matters is the relationship of dependence. And that, for instance, that could be eternal. So it's about the relationship of everything at any moment to its source, rather than flicking over the first domino or something that happened at the very beginning.
Okay. So you're talking about the presence, like, we can think in terms of a 2D world. We live in a 2D world, and then God and the supernatural is on the third dimension, so we cannot really perceive this, the third dimension, but the third dimension is within the 2D world, something like that.
Well, I think that's a good extrapolation from my idea of if you're going to simplify things down to a 1D, one-dimensional sequence of causes, don't think of God as being the cause just at the beginning, but expand it into two dimensions and think of God as the cause holding all causes up. I think that is, you're reflecting my perspective on things there.
Yeah. And how do discoveries in science shape the theological views today? Like, I would imagine that scientists discover something and then theologians try to catch up so that the interpretation of the scriptures can be updated or upgraded. Even though, I mean, I would imagine that the moral standing of the scripture stays there, it cannot be updated because that's not the domain of science. But when it comes to scientific discoveries, maybe there is some discussion within theologians.
Well, there have been particular moments when I think there have been shifts. So, for instance, over whether the first book of the Bible is to be taken as a historical account of things. And you could point to people in this university, geologist Sedgwick, who was a Anglican clergyman, great geologist, who was accumulating evidence for the age of the Earth, and of course Darwin later on.
What was he doing about the age of the Earth?
He was looking at sedimentation and that sort of thing, I think.
And he was a priest?
Yep, he was a canon of Norwich Cathedral.
Okay.
In fact, they have an exhibition. Last time I was there, they had a Diplodocus. They had an enormous dinosaur in their cathedral for a little while.
So I didn't think that God put the dinosaurs there to prove the faith of humans.
He wouldn't. I mean, he was a great scientist. He's a little bit before a lot of work on dinosaurs. But they have got his rock collecting bag and his rock scrambling shoes and things, because they're very proud of their connection with him.
Okay.
So what were we talking about there? So there would be some examples of where perspectives have shifted, and one might be the age of the Earth, for instance. But it's not like this was completely new in modernity. Augustine of Hippo is a good example of someone looking at the text of the beginning of Genesis and saying we shouldn't take this as being a historical, just like.
Augustine was in, when was it?
From the fourth into the fifth century,
yeah.
And probably the most influential of all writers for Western Christians. And he said, well, in the story, the sun and the moon aren't made until the fourth day. So these days, that were the 6 days, can't be literal days. So he thought, in a sense, everything had been created in one go. And this was just a kind of unfolding a story in time, because that's how humans think.
So already back then there was some thinking in terms of we shouldn't take whatever is written in the Genesis in the literal.
He also said that he thought that it was probably a longer story, that some things were created in a seed-like form and had to unfold later. And someone like Origen of Alexandria, the generation or two before, almost completely allegorized it. So he was even further away. What I would say, I think, though, is I would resist the idea that what they're offering is a non-literal interpretation, just in this sense, that I think that they're taking the literary form of the text seriously, that it is, for instance, amongst other things, a poem. So if someone comes to me and says, oh, you don't take the Bible literally enough because you don't treat it like it was a Victorian textbook or something, I'm going to say, no, actually, I think you might be the one who's not taking it literally in a certain sense if you're ignoring its literary form. So I don't want to cede too lightly the idea that a fundamentalist reading of Genesis is somehow the literally responsible one, because, like Augustine says, recognizing it kind of gives itself away that it's about more than just trying to tell a scientific story.
Okay, so
there's a wonderful Master of Trinity College here. It was also Master of Wadham in Oxford. It was Bishop of Chester, John Wilkins, and he was one of the founders of the Royal Society. And he said, well, the Bible doesn't address science because it would be too interesting. So he's a wonderful kind of scientific geek of his time.
Mm.
And he says, the Bible is restricted to matters of faith and morals, basically. How to live with one another, how to live with God. And he said, oh, and if it was all about science, we'd just get distracted because it would be so interesting, which I think is charming for this man that helped found the Royal Society. But also he saw that as an impetus then for his scientific work. He said, "When this book isn't going to tell us about the moon. We've got to get our telescopes out and sort it out." I think that's really lovely for someone who helped to found one of the world's great scientific societies.
So basically there are different layers which you can read the scriptures. And the same sort of thing applies to Dante's Divina Commedia, where you have different layers. There is the literal, the moral, the political, the philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit more about these different layers and how people were writing things in that? Because I think this is something that is peculiar of the Middle Ages, right? And we've kind of lost this sort of a tradition of writing.
So the Middle Ages, you get, it goes actually back into antiquity and especially associated with Alexandria. is a fourfold reading. So you have they have the literal or historical meaning. Then they always found a meaning that pointed to Christ, one that pointed to how to live, morals, and one that pointed to future life. And they're called the four senses of Scripture. Now, I think my biblical studies colleagues, some of them at least, won't particularly like that. They say we should treat it like any other historical text, and they might think of that as being somewhat too allegorical or trying to go against the intention of the author to draw these other things out. I think in the 21st century, after decades of postmodernism and a sort of work in literary theory, some people might push back against that and say, it's just very difficult to work out what the intention of the author is. Texts always have a life beyond themselves. Mm. And also, the Bible itself can be quite creative in these sorts of ways. So if you look at how Paul uses some of the Hebrew passages, he'll allegorize them. He'll take Isaac and Jacob and tell us that they stand for these big theological ideas. People would be looking back, especially it's about Christians reading the earlier scriptures and seeing in there, well, you could say prophecies about Christ, but you could also say that they illustrate general principles that can be kind of lifted
it's
out.
It's like the story of Joseph.
I mean, almost any story at all could be looked at that way. And there's certainly an interest in theology faculties now to have, yes, very careful historical studies that look at archaeology, for instance, and the mythologies of surrounding cultures and all that sort of thing, but also to take in what's called reception history, so that actually to read a text is more than just saying, what do we think it meant at the time, but also what's the life that this text has taken on since, and what's it produced, what's it given rise to. A theology faculty is like a little world, really. It's like the whole of a arts and humanities, even social sciences school rolled into one, and you'll find many different perspectives on the same questions, which I think is quite healthy.
Okay. So now let's talk about the exotheology, or the intersection between theology and astrobiology. So I'm curious to know a little bit more about your book. You wrote a book, Astrobiology and Christian Doctrine, where you mentioned that theologians have been writing about the theological implications of biological life beyond Earth since the mid-15th century. So what did they write? And how was that received by the establishment?
Human beings have been writing about this for a lot longer, and I think the atomists, since the classical period, yeah. So the atomists particularly thought that the world contained it was infinite, and it contained every possible combination of everything an infinite number of times, so that's going to give you other life. But within Christianity, I suppose the tradition that goes furthest back is discussion about whether there's life at the other end of the earth. So unlike the caricature of these sort of people as stupid and thinking about the world as flat and so on, generally people knew that the world was spherical because it's a good Platonic shape. And
it's so more perfect.
It's more perfect, yeah. Exactly. And the question was then, if for one reason or another, either by oceans or perhaps they thought that around the equator was extremely hot, if life was cut off, and you basically had two separate populations. You had this other part of the world, which they called the Antipodes, which is where we get that yeah. word from, people whose feet pointed in the opposite direction. And you get a steady stream of discussion about whether there would be life there, how it could be related to us, how did our theological stories, religious stories relate to that. And, you know, sometimes the science is good, sometimes it's not. It's not about life elsewhere in the universe, but it's quite a nice analogy about thinking whether there could be unconnected life and how it might be similar or different from us. But then it takes a certain kind of displacement of Aristotelian science to get the question about life elsewhere going. And one of the things that I found very interesting is that if people before 1450 didn't think there was much possibility of life elsewhere in the universe, That was as much for scientific reasons as theological ones. Okay. So one theological reason you get against it is that life is constituted by interrelation. They have a really social sense of what life is. And they found the idea of fundamentally separated life in that offended against that principle. So that's one theological reason that's sometimes put forward. But more often, people argue against the presence of other worlds on faulty scientific grounds. So they'll say, for instance, that it doesn't make sense for there to be more than one center to which matter is attracted. And they think, wouldn't this planetary system elsewhere or whatever be eventually pulled into ours and it would all crash, and the kind of great mechanism of the machines of the heavens would all grind up against one another.
Okay.
Or they've kind of backed themselves into a corner by saying the cosmos is the sum of all matter, and there can't be more than one cosmos because there can't be more than one sum. So that's a kind of unfortunate kind of definitional problem there.
So sort of fallacies that we recognize
just kind of
them
fallacies
as fallacies.
Or just, you know, faulty science. And so in 1277, is it? Late-ish 13th century, there are some condemnations from the Bishop of Paris, Archbishop of Paris, that tend to stress divine power. And they rule out saying things like, God couldn't create another world. And that is theologically what starts to open up the possibility of thinking about other life in the cosmos, and the eclipse of this faulty science. And then by the middle of the 15th century, and I just can't find any earlier examples than that, you start finding people who say, yep, there could be life elsewhere. So there's William of Verulam, who's a Franciscan, quite respected theologian. He writes about a paragraph in one of his works. And Nicholas of Cusa is interesting because he rises to be probably the second most powerful, influential person in the church of his day, in the Catholic Church, in the Western Church. He is very politically involved. He writes the Catholic Concordance, which is about polity and whether it should be like a divine, whether it should be a papal monarchy or whether we should have a more democratic conciliar system. And he's like the last flowering of a Platonically infused Christianity before the Reformation, or at least the last great, well, I suppose it carries on flowering. But this, I think he's a really remarkable figure. And he wrote a book called On Learned Ignorance. And at one point, he's talking about life elsewhere in the solar system. He's not particularly thinking about other planetary systems, although he's notable for thinking that that it might not make any sense to talk about there being a center in the universe, that it might all be relative. So that already is starting to open things up. But in just kind of flippantly, almost in passing, he says, yeah, there'll be life elsewhere, and some of it will be more advanced than us, and some of it will be less advanced than us. And he just moves on. But then you don't need to wait very long before there is more of a defensive position. So Philip Melanchthon, who's Luther's right-hand man, slightly younger, he wrote a science textbook in which he says, oh, it can't possibly be the case that there's life elsewhere in the universe because it would cause us too many theological problems. I don't like closing down what the scientific options are on theological grounds, but unfortunately he does that. And then there's Bruno, your fellow Italian, who's burnt at the stake in 1600.
Why? Well, what happened with him?
For a long time it was said that it was his belief in life elsewhere in the universe. But there's other things going on as well.
Was it for political reasons that it was burned?
Well, he was clearly, not very far before you've got Savonarola, haven't you? And so there's definitely a lot of you can't say religious things without it having political, social impact. You probably can't say that today, but you certainly couldn't say it in Florence at that time.
Especially when there was the Inquisition.
Exactly. Yeah. So of all the things that he was definitely seen as a trouble causer and as destabilizing the structure. But I think of all the philosophical, theological things that he said, it seems that they didn't like the idea that he thought the universe was infinite. And they didn't like the idea that he was suggesting the world was somehow made out of God. There was something quite pantheistic about it, as if God was the matter out of which the world was made. That would be enough to get you unfortunately, that would be, you know, in the days when they burnt people at the stake, that'll be enough to get you into trouble. And the fact that Nicholas Accusa, not that far before, can be talking about this and not get himself into trouble suggests to me that what's happened is that the whole religious scene has got more fearful.
Yeah.
So the church isn't at peace anymore, it's split, there are wars. This is going to be a period when people are just not going to be as adventurous and they're going to be more easily threatened. So then once communities are starting to get more settled and confident again, you start pretty soon afterwards finding, well, you mentioned John Ray. Did you mention, no, you haven't mentioned him yet.
No.
No, sorry, that was a conversation I was having with some students this morning. So he's sometimes called the father of English natural history, and he writes a book where in passing he just says, well, of course those other stars out there are also suns and they've got planets around them and they're teeming with life. John Wilkins, I have mentioned, who wrote a book about life on the moon.
Okay.
Which is the breadth of these people's learning. He's quoting things in Greek and Latin, and even though he's got a Puritan sympathizer, he's talking about contemporary Roman Catholic theologians. He quotes Nicholas Accusa, he's all these pagan philosophers. They just had such astonishing education. So once you get into the, what do I mean, 17th century, it's just a steady witness, really, to people writing about this from a theological perspective. And of course, it's quite difficult to separate theology and science at this period. People, if they're writing scientific books, they'll bring theology in. If they're writing theological books, they'll bring science in. And they're generally, you know, quite happy about it. And that goes on through to, well, one of my favourite examples of this is Anthony Trollope. It's probably the archetypal English Victorian novelist. And he's probably his most famous novel, Barchester Towers. In one scene, he wants to show what educated women in a drawing room would be talking about over their tea or whatever it is.
Okay.
And they talk about life elsewhere in the universe and its theological implications. And there's a whole page of Barchester Towers. And he's not saying, oh, aren't they unusual for doing that? He's just, this is what people were talking about. So there was an edition of Harper's Bazaar, was it Harper's magazine, from the 1920s that has a piece on life elsewhere in the universe and theology.
Because during that time it started entering the science fiction realm as well, right? Life elsewhere.
We do tend to think, it's very easy to fall into the mistake of thinking that one's own period is uniquely intelligent and open and so on. But I think it's a pretty much an unbroken tradition of writing about this that goes back centuries. But as I say, because people were generally not worried about it, they didn't write very much about it. So there's certainly more work to be done. I hope I'm involved with that, to ask a wider range of questions and so on. But it's not something that suddenly burst on the scene in the 21st century.
So what were the major implications? So let's say that life exists outside our planet. What would be the major implications in terms of theology?
Well, I don't want to put people off from buying my book, but I have to say that I don't think that there are that many shattering implications. There are lots of ways in which we can be interested and we can think about new and broader ways of thinking about it. But I think for most topics in Christian theology, it can be taken in its stride. So maybe the two examples I'd point to where it's a bit more provocative would be thinking about Christ. I mean, he's obviously at the centre of Christianity, there's clues in the name. And until the 20th century, there isn't really much appetite for wondering whether what Christians think has happened in Christ could be replicated elsewhere. So, you know, there could be more than one incarnation. So, you know, God coming up among us and taking up our flesh. There's a poem from, it's presumably written about the 1910s. It's published in the 1920s by a Roman Catholic author called Alice Meynell, and called Christ in the Universe. And that's the earliest I think I know of someone really inhabiting quite traditional Christianity and thinking that what happened on earth would happen elsewhere. It's a really beautiful poem. I quite often use it in public lectures and that kind of thing. So I'd say the main topic of conversation amongst theologians interested in life elsewhere in the universe in the last few decades has been whether it makes sense to talk about more than one incarnation or not. And the other question, which I think hasn't been talked about at all, and I think maybe is an original contribution of my book, has been to say, if you go down that line, if you don't think that what happened on Earth is unique amongst where it could happen elsewhere, and that God has dealt as intimately with life elsewhere as on Earth, then I think it becomes much more difficult to suppose that human life is at the centre of everything. And Christianity, amongst with many other religions, has tended to think of the end of all things as not being just a scientific process, but God kind of calling time on the universe. It's like in the pubs in the olden days, they used to say, "Time, gentlemen, please."
Yeah.
And that's, you know, a very gendered way of talking about it, but it's what they used to say. "Time, everyone, please," you could say nowadays, and properly. And so people have thought about the end of the universe as being, "Time, everyone, please." Yeah. You know, it's the image of the last trumpet, rather than just heat death or big crunch or whatever the science will say. And of course, people have thought about that as being something in human history. And I think if you end up decentering things so that you don't think that what's happened in human history is the center of everything, not that it's not amazing and wonderful, it's not devalued, I think, by saying that other things have happened elsewhere, then I think it becomes more difficult to imagine that the end of everything is a moment in human history, which of course for the non-theologically minded person is going to seem like the most obvious thing. But I don't think Christianity has really entertained that idea of a kind of post-human history for the universe. And I react to that in various ways.
Like, well, first of all, what do you mean by post-human?
Well, the idea that that the universe will trundle on perfectly happily without us.
Okay.
And I don't think that many religious imaginations have really entertained that. They've thought that there's this, you know, the shutter comes down. And this has very practical consequences. So there are certainly religious groups that think that because the end of the world is about to happen, it doesn't really matter how you treat the earth. In fact, you may as well despoil it. It might bring the end on more quickly. Whereas if, most likely the history will play its course, it'll go on well beyond us, then, you know, if we trash the earth is trashed. I could talk more about that, but I know that particularly the work of the New Center is very much about the origins of life. And I think the theological center of gravity is going to be to pull the conversation towards questions that for which you need rational creatures with moral responsibility and good and evil and sin and salvation and all that sort of thing. And I'm perfectly happy to think about those things, and I have done. But I think what's so exciting about this New Center is it's going to keep pulling us back rather to the other end of the historical spectrum and say, what about the transition from non-life to life?
Yeah. Now, if you remember, in 1996, Bill Clinton announced maybe we found the evidence of microbial life on a Martian asteroid,
mm-hmm.
ALH84001. But it didn't seem that society responded hysterically. There weren't riots. There wasn't any major disruption. So, how do you think society would react by the announcement of either microbial life outside our planet or the presence of the detection of some alien civilization, maybe more intelligent than us or more advanced than us?
Well, I think, really, the specifics matter a great deal there.
Yeah, there is a big difference between the two cases.
But I think even if we find evidence of only very simple life, it will count as one of the greatest scientific leaps, achievements of the history of humanity. And then it'll pose questions about the value of human life. Does the fact that we're not sort of we're on a uniquely inhabited planet matter? I find that these questions are the responses people make to these questions are very kind of deep, innate, almost psychologically structured. So it's the same really question of talking about whether there's other life on Earth that might have forms of intelligence that we haven't recognized up till now.
Mm.
It's the same question also about whether there could be, about whether there could be natural origins for things like gratitude, but I'll leave that aside. But for now, I find that one group of people, I find it amongst students, have a strong sense of the connection between uniqueness and standing or stature. And if we're not the only thing, and especially if we're not top of the tree, somehow that degrades us. And I find there's another attitude that is happy to say the more the merrier. And this is definitely my perspective. I don't think I am any less, or you're any less, or anyone's any less remarkable because there are other things alongside them. So I would want to have, I suppose, quite an objective sense of human dignity and worth in my fact that I have memory, intellect, and will, and agency, and love, and the capacity for forgiveness, and all these sorts of things. If it turns out that dolphins can do all of that, or chimpanzees, I don't feel like I am pulled down because other things are lifted up. And it's the same with life elsewhere in the universe. But, and I'm not sure that you could argue me to that position or away from it. It's the kind of person that I am.
Yeah, that's a personal view.
Yeah, and if someone else says, if there are other things that are like us, if we're not
different
from
the special,
then somehow I'm less worthwhile. It's quite difficult to argue people away from that. So I think it's a good example of where it's not necessarily working at a philosophical level, or at least it's grounded in something really quite psychological.
Yeah, it's a personal perception thing.
Yeah. I think we should be... One of the things that I sometimes noted is if we get this data, especially if it's a sign of a non-intelligent life, one day we'll be euphoric because we'll have this fantastic discovery. The next day we'll have loads and loads of questions and almost no capacity that I can think of immediately to make progress. Because you'd have to build a whole new generation of telescopes, and even then, what extra data are they going to give? Well, I don't put any limits on the ingenuity of the scientists, but I think there's going to be quite a strong hangover the next day.
So you're talking about the detection of some biosignatures, which are chemical signatures that we can measure that might indicate that there is some biological entity in a planet out there, but if we want to know more, then we need to build more and more powerful telescopes and maybe eventually go there. Right.
But that could take...
Forever,
I think there's a good prospect of us having this great breakthrough and then maybe imagining that it'll take more than the lifetime of people who are around to be able to make very much progress. And I think we'll come down to Earth with a bit of a thud then.
Yeah.
You asked about the implications that this would have on for people
and society.
And speaking from the perspective that I know a bit about, from the religious perspective, there was this very interesting study, which was spearheaded by Ted Peters.
I read it.
In the United States, and he did what I don't do, which is empirical research. I mean, I think in cooperation with an expert in that field, and he did the obvious thing, but I don't know whether anyone had ever done it before, which was to ask people. So he asked a wide range of people from a wide range of religious perspectives. Basically, would they be threatened? Would their faith be threatened? Would their worldview be challenged if there was evidence of life elsewhere in the universe? And the headline figure is most people said no. There's a bit of a difference between one tradition and another, which you might expect, but generally they said they expected they would take it in their stride. He did a clever thing as well, which was to ask people who didn't espouse any particular religious faith what they thought the religious believer's answer would be. And it was pretty much kind of upside down. So if you ask the religious correspondent, figures, members of the public, they're generally 80, 90% of them are saying, that's fine. If you ask the non-religious people what they thought their religious friends would say, it was pretty much upside down. 70% of them were saying, oh, they're going to find this really challenging. So,
because maybe they're interested in challenging religion.
Yeah, or it just maybe shows that there's a need for more religious, theological literacy, and we don't really understand what other people think. And there's this narrative from the media, from that historical picture which was dominant throughout the 20th century, which is increasingly being debunked, that the basic position between theology, religion, and science is one of enmity and combat and so on. I think that's really seeped into our
which
culture.
Which we see all over the social media and the various debates. And
Whereas I'm in a college that is at least half scientists, and some of them are quite devout, others of them are not, but I haven't come across people who are antagonistic.
Yeah, but that's what makes views. That's what people want to see. People want to see conflict because that keeps them watching
It makes headlines and posts and things, but the idea, you wouldn't write a Twitter post that said this is rather a nuanced thing and it's not easy to summarize and it involves people just being human beings. That doesn't make for a good social media post, does it?
So when the guy, what's his name, Ted Peters, runs the survey, I don't think I can really capture what's going to be the reaction of people, for a very simple reason, that the reaction of people would depend on their mood at that specific time. So if I ask you, how would you react if someone was picking up a fight in a pub? You could tell me something now, but until you are in that specific situation, you're not going to know if you're going to run away or you're going to punch him in the face or I don't know. So it depends. So there is the emotional reaction and a series of things that you cannot really predict sometimes. So I think the reaction of people will be directly proportional to the amount of importance that mainstream media and social media will give to the discovery. So if they say, okay, this is mildly important, maybe it will be forgotten after a week. But if they stress on the importance of this thing, maybe they will. People will really care about this stuff.
Depends what else is happening in the world at the time.
Yeah.
Depends in the way in which it's presented.
I want to talk about the technological developments. And thank you for suggesting this book from David Chalmers. Read half of it. So, intersection between technology and theology. Now, computer processing power has been increasing steadily, and you're probably familiar with the Moore's law, which is basically a law where you plot the logarithm of the amount of amount of transistors within a chip versus time. And there's been it's a straight line, so it has been steadily going up and up since 1975 or something like that.
We might be getting quite close to the quantum mechanical limits.
Yeah,
of how
so
many
there have
get.
Been series of waves of innovation. Now we're in the so-called third wave. I actually discussed this stuff with the Microsystems Technology Office director from DARPA, who is leading this sort of wave of innovation. And now there are apparently new architectures that go beyond the von Neumann architecture, so new types of computing, quantum computers and so on. So with these improvements, we are able to do more and more powerful simulations. So we could think that in some distant future, we will be able to run simulations of how life emerged. For example, we could simulate chemical reactions at a large scale. Or it could even come up with some sort of conscious super AI. So maybe in after some time, we will be able to simulate people, maybe for scientific purposes. So let's see how these people interact. Maybe I'm running a political campaign and I want to see what would be the outcome of my strategy, or maybe I'm a historian, I want to see how people would have behaved back in, I don't know, during some war, the French Revolution, whatever. So there are some people, David Chalmers and Nick Bostrom, that say that it's highly possible that we might live in a simulation. Bostrom in 2003 wrote a book, paper, Are You Living in a Computer Simulation? He said that three of these statements must be true. It says the first one is that human species is very likely to go extinct before reaching a post-human stage. The other one is that any post-human civilization is extremely unlikely to run a significant number of simulations. of their evolutionary history. This is called the simulation block. And the other one is that we are almost certainly living in a computer simulation. Mm-hmm. So this opens up a kind of worms for theology and also gives a different perspective. So if we are living in a computer simulation, what would be the theological implications?
Well, one thing I'd say is that the fundamental questions about creation, the derivation of all things, they just get kicked up a level.
On another level.
Or it could be a simulation within a simulation within a simulation. But eventually you get to stuff and you ask the question about why there's anything rather than nothing, and all the usual questions apply. I have to say I have two reasons why I'm a bit averse to this. One is scientific, and it's the idea of just the complexity of what we would need. I mean, I seem to remember reading that to replicate the complexity of a human brain, you would need a current-day computer about the size of the Isle of Manhattan. And then if you're going to have something that isn't just a brain, you know, a person, well, that's, of course, the relationship between those two things is contested. But you're going to simulate a whole world in which that is to be found. I just don't know whether it seems that.
But for the human brain, and I guess you explore this topic quite a lot, isn't it probably a matter of how the neurons are interconnected and the function that these neurons have? Because, I mean, I could come up with something that is the size of a human brain with some circuitry neural networks, and maybe I managed to find the right types of connections and whatever activation functions, and maybe that thing works. So I don't need that huge computer.
But even if you have that, you also need the bigger simulation, which is of all of reality that you might possibly ever come across. And that feels profligate, put it that way. I mean, I'm no general, in wider questions of ethics and theology, I'm no great enthusiast for William of Ockham, but there does seem to be a certain kind of... so this brings me on to the second act. So scientifically, I think it's a very big ask. And then just philosophically, I will tend to take the non-solipsistic angle.
That
it's not all about me, that things are not more complicated than they look, that there seems to be something a bit elitist or kind of Gnostic about the idea of the enlightened person who turns to the other 6 billion people and says, now, of course, you think that material stuff is material stuff and, you know, all the rest, but actually I'm the enlightened person who can tell you that it's all it's a simulation. So I just have that kind of, again, it's probably quite knee-jerk and psychological. And I have to admit that there is a fundamental Christian championing of matter and materiality and the goodness of matter. We had that punch up in the early church with the Gnostics and the Manichees who was, you know, wanting to say that reality is spiritual and mental and one has to escape from matter and so on. And it's pretty definitive of the Christian tradition that it pushed back and said, no, matter is a good thing and part of creation, and we need to understand ourselves in terms of flesh and blood and that kind of thing. Maybe that's something I need to get over, but I think I have an inbuilt religious sort of orientation towards the materiality of matter and its goodness. Another thing I'd say is, I guess that all these things, we can get around them, but the role of the body in cognition and the fact that we think in fundamentally bodily ways, I suppose that could be simulated, but we shouldn't too easily think of cognition as this ethereal, intangible thing. People have talked about our thought being embodied, enacted, extended. We use objects and embedded. We think in terms of the context that we're in. I suppose all of that could be simulated. I just think Chalmers, who you mentioned, is quite an important writer on this, has been... To stand against a kind of Cartesianism that would want to try and have the mind floating free of the body and its environment. But I need to think about all of this. I know one of the things that Chalmers says just from reading the review in the TLS about it is a simulated entity needs to be taken seriously as an entity.
Yeah, is that the simulated world is as real as actual world.
I think it makes sense to say we would have moral responsibilities towards if things. I'm really not very sympathetic to this as a possibility, but if things were created that had memory, intellect, will, love, forgiveness, good and evil. Of course, freedom is an interesting question, but I'm open to the idea that a sufficiently complicated system can produce non-deterministic situations. That's an elephant in the room. But if those things existed, then I think we would have to accord them the dignity and protections. The idea of creating them and then snuffing them out, or of manipulating them in a way that we would think was immoral with another human being, I think those
principles
would
apply. So you're saying
that
if we could run a simulation of, let's say, a little world of the 18th century, we should have concerns in terms of how do we treat these simulated beings?
Yeah.
Because they're conscious. Okay.
I think if they had the qualities that we so admire and protect among ourselves, we would be duty-bound to treat them in the same way.
Now, in terms of theological terms, if let's say that we have the technology to run such a simulation, so I go buy some software, and there is a company that sells this simulation software, and I got this super powerful computer that can do all these wonderful things. Maybe it doesn't simulate everything, maybe it just simulates things locally until people go, let's say I take a microscope and then the simulation takes place there so that you don't need to spend a huge amounts of computing power. But let's say that this is possible. So when I press the button, simulate, start the universe, maybe I accelerate things and I change parameters to make certain things happen. Would I be the god for those people within the simulation? That's the sort of a theological question. So is the god, am I the god for them in their perspective?
Well, there are ways of using words that are not absolutely the same and not absolutely different. I wouldn't want to use the word god there univocally.
Now, god with the small
d. I wouldn't certainly want to, so I'm not using it in exactly like I would use, say that a bungalow and a mansion are both a house. But neither am I maybe using it exactly like we would say that the bark of the tree and the bark of a dog, there's really no connection at all. I think, as you might expect, it falls to the theologian to gravitate towards pointing out the ways in which we wouldn't be like God. One is we wouldn't be making anything out of nothing. And
we wouldn't be the
absolute origin of all being.
We wouldn't be the creator and the designer at the same time, because if I'm buying the software, someone else is designing that. Right?
And it's running on silicon and so on. So that's one thing. And also, the human brain has, in this hypothetical situation, has been clever enough to make this software, but the system that it's running completely outstrips the creator. You wouldn't be able to look at the software and be able to understand everything in one vision. You wouldn't be immanent to it. So I think it wouldn't take. So in a sense, it wouldn't take divine transcendence seriously enough that God is beyond and infinite. And
even though
so
you
on.
Could have some analytics tool that does statistics. Okay, we got this number of people. They are happy. They are sad. Yeah. And all this thing.
That's not the same thing as being like Augustine says. God is closer to me than I am to myself. Intimately present to everything and every aspect. Again, we wouldn't be like that.
You wouldn't be able to do that because you don't have the mental capabilities to do such a thing.
But this is completely new territory for me to be thinking about virtual reality and simulations and so on. But it seems like Chalmers has really got the hair running.
Yeah, and another question that he asks is that what would be the motivation for a simulated being to worship the simulator?
Hmm.
Which also translates to what's the motivation for someone that comes to the conclusion that there is God, to worship God.
Mm.
And in fact, I mean, I'm saying this because taking the perspective of the simulated words gives some unique perspective into theology, I guess.
It's not a completely unfamiliar image. So I've mentioned Dorothy L. Sayers already. She wrote a book called The Mind of the Maker in the middle of the 20th century.
Okay.
She was a novelist, most famous for Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Wimsey and this series of wonderful detective novels. And she also translated Dante into English rhyming couplets, which is not an easy thing to do.
Do you read Dante in Italian or you read...
Well, I read it in English with an Italian, with the Italian next to it. I can't just read it without the... But I revere Dante as one of the world's greatest writers. So she's a translator of Dante.
Okay.
She wrote she wrote some wonderful radio plays. How did I get to Dorothy L. Sayers? What were we talking? Oh, she wrote a book called The Mind of the Maker. So she
The Mind of the Maker.
She explores the author story relationship as an analogy between that of the creator and the creation.
Okay.
Which is, and it's not exactly the same as this simulation, but it shows that, that these things have been looked at from, you know, somewhat equivalent angles.
Because one thing is acknowledging that the simulator or the creator did a great thing and you are thankful for the creation. But another thing is worshipping the creator. There is a difference between the two.
Yeah, so there's a sort of, I see that there might be a parallel there in terms of gratitude and recognition of a source. The theological idea of God goes beyond that because it's the source of, I mean, the source of the matter, the laws, the fact that there's anything rather than nothing. But I can see that there's an analogy there. I suppose one of the things that shifts gratitude into worship is also the sense of excellence. So I think maybe something within a simulation would recognize the intellectual prowess of the one who'd made it, but that wouldn't necessarily shade into, for instance, moral goodness or beauty. So it's striking how much religious traditions circle around the idea of God as beautiful and God as good. And it may not necessarily follow in this simulation model that people would think that the coder was all good, all beautiful.
Maybe it's a 5-year-old child playing in
with,
the bedroom.
With a kind of Minecraft 2.0, yeah.
Creating any sort of destruction and cataclysms and making them suffer and all these things.
Yeah.
Now, do you think simulated beings, and that thing applies also to aliens maybe, so let's say that we run this simulation, we start a new universe, we let it evolve, and then we run, I don't know, hundreds of these simulations, and then until some intelligent species pops up. Do you think they will develop religion, and any religion? Do you think they will...
So we can take that question out of the simulation
as well.
We
could
just
aliens,
talk about the stuff out there.
The aliens out there, do you think they would develop... sense of spirituality, belief in God and religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of work done in the last few decades about whether religion is an overarching category or not, whether you can gather up a disparate range of human behaviours and traditions and call them the same thing. And one of the angles against that... There are common things.
Yeah.
But one of the arguments against it has been the ones that do it almost always subsume everything else to their model. You end up saying, religion is basically like Christianity and we're going to make all these things like it or whatever. There's just a human sort of inbuilt tendency to extrapolate from what you understand as being as if that was the overarching category. So that one of the reasons against the idea of at least too hastily lumping religion together has been it's tended to subsume it under a kind of often economically and culturally dominant paradigm. Nonetheless, and I'm not an anthropologist, it does seem that certain dispositions and forms of behavior are as old as humanity and recur, you know, pretty much everywhere, and they would be about reverence, certain kind of taboos and undoable, unthinkable things, marking rites of passage, beginning and end of life, puberty and marriage, alliances between houses.
Cooperation.
Yeah. So these seem to be pretty widespread. So I think that the anthropologist might say if Earth is anything to go by, then creatures that can are self-reflexive and can reflect upon their stages of life and these big questions like, is there a standard of goodness and evil? Why is there anything rather than nothing? How do we know what's true? These seem like, to me, like questions that would emerge elsewhere, although I have to be agnostic about whether there are different forms of intelligence for which these sorts of questions don't emerge. But I'm a metaphysical realist, so I tend to think that the mind conforms itself to a reality objective and beyond itself, rather than just kind of making it up. So if Earth is anything to go by, you might expect that people would, creatures elsewhere, would be trying to navigate, you know, uncertainty and complexity and moral complexity with something that's vaguely analogous. Now, there are people who talk about other creatures as having evolved beyond it. Mm. I think Jill Tarter, who was involved with SETI, is a good example of this. I think it's a bit of sort of affirming the consequent, making a prior decision about religion being a backward thing, and then on the basis of that saying, because they're advanced, therefore they've given up on it. Well, maybe
which is a bit offensive for religious people.
Well, it seems to me that it assumes the thing that you want to prove, that the question remains, is religion necessarily a backward thing, and is it something that one would move beyond? Maybe it's quite a Western perspective, European perspective, perhaps, to think that the world's becoming less religious. If we were in other parts of the world, that might not look like the way in which history is going. I think we would probably, if we could communicate, we would find things to talk about. It seems to me, over good and evil, beauty, truth, being. I suppose I'm a philosophically minded kind of person. For me, theology and philosophy are very, you know, they overlap, they share important boundaries. And so it's partly because I don't think the philosophical questions will go away, that I, you know, can imagine there being parallels elsewhere. And also because I, perhaps someone who doesn't think of there being such a tight boundary between philosophy and theology, that seems like quite a modern thing. Down most of human history, the things that look like philosophy and the things that look like religion or theology have been pretty intermingled.
Probably these questions that we have in philosophy, these big questions we have in philosophy, what's the meaning of life, where are we going, why are we here?
Partly depends what kind of philosophy you are.
Is it possible that these things are baked in evolution? That's baked in the biology of humans, a result of the way we evolved, to survive, try to...
There are evolutionary accounts of religion, and that doesn't necessarily mean that, even on that view, that religion wouldn't be present elsewhere. I mean, if you think that religion comes about because it's evolutionary beneficial, it tends to stabilize societies, it tends to create heroism, it tends to all sorts of other things that people have said. Or I think less plausible, but there are ways in which brains develop and psychology, and it's a kind of artifact. So one theory is we've evolved to detect agency. It's better to have a brain that detects it too much than too little, because it's best to be scared of rustling leaves than to be eaten by a tiger. And that leads us to detect agency in the universe, that, you know, in the form of a maker that isn't there. So that's the sort of hyperactive agency detection module. Theory, I think it has lots of problems. But even if you did accept an evolutionary basis for the emergence of religion, that would seem to me more actually an argument in favor of it turning up elsewhere. Whereas I am more inclined to say that evolution has given us pretty omnicompetent brains that can think about all sorts of things that don't have directly evolutionary benefits, like abstract mathematics and that kind of thing. And it's a bit of a genetic fallacy to say that just because an evolutionary process has given us brains, that the only thing that the brain can do is to serve an evolutionary process.
Yeah, but why do we do math? We do math maybe because we're curious, and curiosity, well, curiosity, why are you curious? Originally, maybe because you want to find new food.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the things that we're curious about have got to then only serve evolutionary.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess these are remnants of previous traits that we had, like, why do we compete in sports? That comes from previous abilities that we had because of the way we evolved, and we keep doing those things even if there is no, we're not being chased by some wild animals, but we still like to run.
Yeah, I would say that that looks like, you might say, a material condition, but not, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition, or it's a material condition, it's not a formal one. It's true that we couldn't run or compete in gymnastics or, you know, dance at the ballet unless we'd had this evolutionary story. But the idea that that explains or explains away what's happening at the ballet or...
No, of course not.
That doesn't also talk about it as being about the quest for excellence, beauty, honour, competition, traditions. I think this is a really good example of how the picture would, without the science, that evolutionary explanation would be incomplete. But it can't. It doesn't.
Can't explain everything. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the other thing I want to ask you is about. I think that's something you mentioned before about multiple incarnations in different planets. So what's the motivation of justification for transferring concepts that are that basically belong to Christianity, dogmas of Christianity, to other civilizations outside our world? Why do you think this thing would happen in other worlds? For example, the incarnation. Mm-hmm. Is there any justification for transferring these concepts?
Well, I think there's a distinction between saying this is the way in which one views the world and saying it's inconceivable that anyone could think differently. So, and that would apply to philosophical traditions as well. I mean, if you're a Hegelian, then you really think the world works according to Hegelian principles, and they are the tools of thought that you have, and you're going to think about the world elsewhere, including whatever else there is in the cosmos. And all being well, you'd have a certain humility about saying, of course, it's possible that this isn't the right way of looking at things, and I'll try and give an account of why I think about it, and I'll listen to you why you don't think that way. And I think that's somewhat like the way in which a Christian is going to say, well, these are my bearings, this is how I make sense of the world. And I'm going to try and make sense of other things that way. And I am open to the prospect that I might have got it wrong or that my thinking needs to develop. So that's part of what's going on. I mean, it could be very arrogant, or it could be almost quite humble, saying, well, we've all got, all thought is mediated through some kind of structure and concepts and axioms, and these are mine, and that's how I understand the world. And I'm very happy to talk to you about yours, and let's have a good conversation. So in the book, I wanted to make a distinction between some things that the book just wouldn't be an exercise in Christian theology if it thought otherwise, and other topics that seemed to me were much more up for grabs. So I wasn't going to say, let's imagine the world wasn't created. It doesn't have this relationship of dependence. I wasn't going to say, let's imagine that Christianity is just completely wrong in thinking about God as being three in one. Those would be great books, but they just wouldn't be the book from the tradition that I'm writing out of. But I wanted to keep my tethers, the things I was jumping off from, relatively few in number and fundamental. So I particularly wanted to leave open questions like, does every culture of intelligent beings always kind of go down morally disastrous trajectories or not? And I also wanted to say, God is free to respond to other creatures in a way that's appropriate to that what they are and their own stories, and also to recognize that Christians have wanted to say that God's free. So I wanted to leave that plenty that was contingent, and in fact the book ends up being an exploration of, don't just think it has to be A, why not let's think also about B. It's a sort of a bit of a tree diagram of just how broad the territory is that we might explore, but the tree has to start from somewhere. And I was starting from God as Trinity and Creator. And you're going to gravitate to the things that you think are most fundamental. And Christian tradition is probably going to say there's this sense that God has spoken. And most of all, there's the sense that God has come among us by taking up our nature. And I am open to the idea that that hasn't happened elsewhere, and I'm open to the idea that it has. And my argument is what I think of as a kind of Star Wars analogy.
Okay.
So at the beginning of Star Wars, as I remember from my childhood, it says, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, and then it tells the story. And my discussion of multiple incarnations sort of hinges on this, and it's a kind of counterfactual. What if there was only one incarnation in the universe, and what if it wasn't here? What if it was elsewhere? In that case, we'd open Luke's gospel, and in the first chapter, rather than saying, in the ninth month, God sent the angel Gabriel to a virgin whose name was Mary, espoused to Joseph, and the story of the Annunciation and the Nativity and all the rest. Instead of saying that, it would say, long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, this thing, this creature that you can't even imagine, had this thing happen to it that you can't even imagine, and then these things happened which you can't imagine, especially if the body is very different and we think in a very bodily way, we just have no traction. Now, from a theological perspective, I would be perfectly happy to say that what happened long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away could redeem the world. But it's pretty integral to Christianity that God has drawn near to us, become one of us. Well, Aquinas says, because the only way that God could be friends with us and we could be friends with God would be, or at least it's appropriate, that there should be this sense of being among us as one of us. Or you could think about, you know, revelation and communication. It's a big idea, goes back centuries and centuries, millennia, that in the scriptures and in the story of the incarnation, God has accommodated himself to us, which is to say, God has spoken to us in the way that we could receive. And often the image is of like in a nursery, you talk to a child in a different way than you talk to an adult. You kind of descend to their level and you talk to them in a way that they can understand. Now, generally Christians haven't thought that the incarnation is only about communication, isn't only about intimacy and friendship, but that's part of what's happening. And if it's an important part of what's happening, then to open Luke's gospel and find just a story of something that I can't comprehend, it just doesn't feel like what Christians have said the incarnation is about. So on that basis, because I think God has drawn near to us and it really matters that we've seen God face to face, a Christian would say, I err towards thinking that other creatures would see God face to face in a face that they could understand. But, you know, I will not try to be prescriptive. I'm mainly in the book trying to open up a broad range of options and show it's broader perhaps than people have sometimes thought. And I will tip my hat in the direction of where my instincts lie, but it's no more than that.
Okay. Last thing I wanted to ask you is, how would we interact with this hypothetical alien civilization that we might encounter one day? That we are in the realm of science fiction, how would you interact with them? And how would you interact with them and judge them if they were really different from us, if they didn't have concepts like love or compassion, if they were like reptilians?
Well, my own work tends always to veer away from contact kinds of narratives, partly because I think sometimes you're mistaken for that's what, if you think about this sort of topic, that's what you have to be interested in. In fact, you probably have to believe you've already been visited. And I try to sort of keep a bit of blue water between myself and that.
You believe in the UFO stories and all this.
Get in the newspaper about this, and I tell you receive quite a lot of strange emails. And, you know, with pictures and maps and things. So it really isn't my area of specialism. I think there's a fascinating set of questions about language. And I think there's a group setting up an initiative in Cambridge on exo-language.
Okay.
Which I can dig out some details for you. So there are lots of interesting questions about that, and there's some work done on it. On the ethical questions...
I think about that, Dieter Quello said that we can't even talk to animals. How can we think that we can talk to extraterrestrials? Maybe we should first try to talk to dogs and
dolphins. Well, Peter Godfrey Smith has a wonderful book about octopuses.
Okay.
Saying that we should not underestimate both the intelligence of these creatures and the utter strangeness. You know, so they've got a brain in each limb as well as in the head.
Yeah.
So possibly we have alien intelligences among us, and their intelligence is so different from ours that we don't recognize it. For which reason I've stopped eating octopus. So I think there are all sorts of questions about that. Is personhood a thing? Is the Augustine talks about, as I've mentioned before, human beings being characterized by memory, intellect, and will. Is there something about intelligence that's going to converge on those or not? These are great questions, and I'm not sure I've got answers for them. On the moral questions, I tend to personally espouse approaches to ethics that I think are both quite objective and quite flexible. So the tradition of writing about the virtues says there are excellences, which are prudence, courage, temperance, justice, and then several other ones. And then Christianity throws in faith, hope, and love, but we'll talk about the Aristotelian ones. And they are excellent, and that seemed to be an objective thing. But what that looks like in any particular context depends upon the context. So if I am, if I'm sick, for instance, then I'm kind of let off being temperate. I should just basically eat whatever it is that's going to make me better. In religion, you know, again, rules about fasting, for instance. If you're responsible for caring for somebody, then it's not sensible to fast. But if you're in good health, then it's part of the tradition. So, so there's the virtue tradition, which has a useful balance between a sense that there are these things that are excellent, but they get played out according to the context. And then there's also the natural law tradition, which in Thomas Aquinas, I think, is actually pretty well integrated with the virtue tradition. And that, again, has a sense that there are some things that are just quite objectively good, but also a sense that that needs to be worked out contextually. So he has this sense that you also need human positive laws, which respond to the particular situation. So the justice is justice, but what that looks like in a fishing community is going to need different laws from one in a farming community, you know, forestry community or something like that. So I think there are traditions to thinking about ethics, which in these cases are have been expounded in a religious way, but there's direct overlaps with other religions as well and non-religious approaches that would at least give us the beginnings of being able to say we don't have to be complete relativists, but neither do we have to imagine that things just look absolutely like a carbon copy of what right and wrong looks like on Earth. And you sort of talked about the reptilian, you know, the idea of the creatures that are just without mercy, without kindness, without
maybe
love.
That's a stereotype.
I'm
well,
I think
sure.
It's a really interesting question, though, about whether such a civilization could survive. Jesus has this thing about a house that's divided against itself kind of.
We already have reptilians on this planet, right? If you follow David Icke. No, I'm joking.
That yes, that's a different kind of reptilian. I mean, you're talking about the
brain
stem kind of,
yes,
you know, the that's all about preservation and fighting back and so on. Well, I am generally an optimist, and I, you know, maybe I'm in danger of taking a rosy view of things. But I think that there's a good case to be made that civilizations that don't embrace mercy, kindness, generosity, cooperation, are not going to be the ones that survive. You really need to look at the history of Europe in the middle of the 20th century to see that some of the decisions during the Second World War were not good strategic decisions because they were the work of people who weren't open to the perspectives of others, who were whose perspectives were closed down, by unkindness and and became delusional because of a lack of human sympathy.
Yeah, but they didn't stop there.
Yeah, but they, in the end, it undid them. And we're recording this whilst there's a war on in Europe, and it seems that where you have a sense of community, of a service to something that transcends even your own life, that tends to lead to heroism and forms of cooperation that are very useful. So I think that there's, I'm talking off the top of my head, but the idea that a civilization could evolve that lacked these positive virtues and that somehow that would be an advantage, I think that's really open to contestation.
Maybe it depends on the biology of that species. That's hard to say. Well, there are animals that I think there are some spiders that even eat the partner after they mate.
Yep.
Which is creepy. Okay, so I think we reached 2 hours and we're running out of recording space on the hard drive. So I wanted to ask you, when is your book going to be out? So Astrobiology and Christian Doctrine. When can people go and buy it? When is it?
Well, an author always ought to be circumspect about giving exact dates, but I think October 2022.
Okay, and it's published by?
The publisher will be absolutely determined on Friday.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm pretty confident, but I'm not going to insult the board that has to meet on Friday to make a decision.
Okay,
you can
great.
Maybe you can overlay a note at the bottom of the screen saying who it'll be.
Okay, so it has been a pleasure, Andrew.
Been
thank
a pleasure
you very
for
much.
Me as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.